You're listening to the John C. Scott Political Forum. This podcast is a Bustos Media production on The Voice. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Thank you. Good afternoon and welcome to our show, 7-Eleven, July the 11th, 2019. Glad you could join us. A great lineup of guests today. Matt Klink, GOP consultant out of Los Angeles. Paul Cunningham, the Ward 2 City Councilman from Tucson. Margaret Cheney, TEP President. By the way, Margaret's going to be talking about teachers, starting teachers at TUSD, Southern Arizona's largest school district, will have a salary of $40,000. Jeff Rogers, former chair of the Democratic Party, will talk with us. Tom Brzezelski, former legislator and executive committee member of the Pima County Democrats, talks about the hopes of the Democratic Party with a final four that's made up of Biden, Warren, Sanders, and, of course, Harris. Then we'll talk with the former United States Senator, Dennis DeConcini, about the importance of the 2020 census. The president's backed off trying to get a questionnaire as to whether you're a citizen or not on the census. He's apparently given in. Let's talk with Matt Klink, GOP consultant, GOP strategist in Los Angeles. Matt, welcome to the show. I'm glad you could join us. Thank you so much.
Hi, John. Happy Thursday.
Thank you. Give me the president's argument about the census and why it should have included the question, are you a citizen of the United States?
Well, I mean, it was included in the census from the 1800s through the 1950s, and then it was included in the long form of the census up through 2000, at which point Barack Obama made a decision to drop it. So, you know, it has been asked in the past. I think that it is important information to know. But I think that what Trump realized is that, you know, the Supreme Court didn't tell him that he couldn't include it on the census. It's just that his rationale for trying to include it on the 2010 census wasn't in line with the real with what the reasons behind it were. And I think that Trump realized that, you know, doing it via executive order would have just created more controversy. And he said he'll use the Commerce Department to find out that information through other means, which he's well within his right as president to do.
It seems to me that obviously there's a lot at stake here. Perhaps a congressional seat, an additional congressional seat for the state of Arizona, and other states could be affected with another congressional seat as well. That's a big deal for Arizona.
Well, it's a big deal for a lot of states. I mean, whether you're a state that could potentially lose a seat like Arizona or California, or states that could potentially pick up seats, places in the middle of the country. You know, I do think ultimately there is somewhat of a difference of opinion. We've been told 11 to 12 million people are here illegally. There was another study that came out by Yale and MIT, two pretty respected and high-profile institutions, that said the number could be double that. And I just think it's worth knowing what's the true number, because it affects resources, it affects how tax dollars are spent, which is, we should know this information. So whether we get it in the census or not, it's still a number that we need to know.
Well, obviously, for health care and dollars, all kinds of dollars from the federal government, these numbers are really critical. I mean, you've got to get paid for the numbers, period.
Well, they are. But, you know, I guess the point is why do we – what's the fear of not having all of the numbers? And if the question is, well, you won't get certain people to respond, well, that's their choice. But we should have – the best and most accurate information and the most complete information, and not asking that question just makes no sense whatsoever. We should know how many people are in this country, full stop, and we should know how many are in this country illegally, full stop. We can do both.
Let me take you to a subject that I know you're following closely, and that is the final four for the Democratic nominees for President of the United States. Would it be fair to say we've got a final four of Biden, Warren, Sanders, Harris at the moment? Is that the lineup for the final four?
As of today, yes, but I think that you can't exclude Mayor Pete. I think that he's close. He's within striking distance. He raised a ton of money, and I do think that you've got to get him – put him on the big stage with those four and let him compete against them, and the herd will thin itself out over time. But you're seeing Biden drop, and I think that Biden Biden's problem is that he starts high, and he's not a particularly good presidential candidate. We've seen him run twice very badly, and people just forget because he was Barack Obama's running mate. Elizabeth Warren, she seems to be doing really well. Kamala Harris had a great first debate performance, but you know, it's her turn under the spotlight now, and she's going to get a lot more of a hard look by reporters. I think you're going to see some jostling around, but that's probably a good five for the time being. But I still think you'll have about four or five others that will stay alive.
Is it fair to say about Bernie Sanders, who'll been there, done that, we heard that, and okay, now we've got to move on to something else. Is this just a repeat that does not have the energy or the imagination or even the uniqueness of 2016 for Bernie Sanders?
I think, John, you nailed it. I think people are just fatigued by his very his style and his bluntness. I think that they get the same thing, but in a softer package with Senator Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts. And she has the benefit of not being an almost 80-year-old white guy in the Democratic primary. So she can get the Bernie voters what they want. Now, obviously, Elizabeth Warren has some problems of her own to deal with, but I just think that people are fatigued with Bernie, that his moment in the sun was 2016.
But, you know, I followed his campaign here in Tucson, and he had a couple of rallies here that were just amazing. I mean, the energy level was just, you couldn't even count it, the decibels. It was absolutely real. People reaching out to touch him and wanted to hear what he had to say. He had a following. There was a lot of, real compassion and passion, for that matter, for Sanders in 2016 in a progressive city like Tucson, university community and whatever. And that was all across the country. I don't sense that this time around at all.
No, look, I agree with you, John. He has his supporters. The problem is that, you know, because of where he is geographically, he and Elizabeth Warren, when they go up to New Hampshire, they're going to compete for the same pool of voters because of the proximity of Vermont and Massachusetts to New Hampshire. And if they're both around at that time, only one of them is going to emerge with the big word in the primaries is momentum, because momentum leads you from North Carolina or from New Hampshire, you know, to the next stop, which I believe at that point is South Carolina. And that's where, so they're going to, one of the two of them is going to make it. And like the thought process too was, it's either going to be Cory Booker or Kamala Harris. It won't be both of them. And right now it would appear that it's Kamala Harris, but she's one screw up away from letting Cory Booker back into this, and he has his ardent supporters as well. So I don't think that the five are fixed, but I do think that they certainly have an advantage, which right now is going to translate into money.
We're talking with Matt Klink, a GOP consultant and strategist out of Los Angeles, one of the most respected GOP consultants in all of America. Matt, President Trump has said he's going to look very closely at the Labor Secretary Alex Acosta's handling of the sex trafficking case involving the now jailed billionaire and financier Jeffrey Epstein. He's also going to stand by his cabinet official, praising Acosta's performance on the job, saying he felt very badly for him. Can he actually save Acosta from this continued spotlight, from this illumination that's getting really quite warm for the Labor Secretary?
Well, I don't know if he can. I mean, I don't know if he's going to, the secretary is going to need saving. I mean, this is a really weird case. President Clinton is involved, who flew with him something like 20 plus times on his private jet. Trump, who was not particularly close to him, but had met with him in the early 2000s. You know, Acosta, who was a federal prosecutor, who made a deal with him that was apparently because witnesses were unwilling to testify. There's more here than meets the eye. And I don't think that anyone is. It just goes to show to you that there are laws, and that there are laws for the super rich, and that he did something, or prompt he being the accused, let's just say that he had a lot of political connections on both sides, and everybody, I think, just wants it to go away. But the Democrats are gonna hound the secretary on this for as much as they can, and if he were to be forced to resign, it would be another cabinet member torpedoed for President Trump, and that would further weaken Donald Trump, which is what Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi ultimately want. But unless there's a smoking gun, he's not going anywhere.
Well, you know, I have no excuse at all for Bill Clinton. If he was involved in any way, shape, or form, burn him. Burn him to the ground. Burn him. You know, I mean, there's just no excuse for this. I mean, you're not going to excuse any of this. It's too disgusting, yeah. Really.
It's funny. I was just going to say that exact word. It's beyond gross. It's disgusting and pathetic that this was allowed to exist and happen when apparently a lot of people knew about it. So, I mean, he deserves his day in court, but everything that's been made public does not sound very good. It sounds really, really troubling, and no one comes out of this smelling like a rose.
We're talking with Matt Klein, GOP consultant out of Los Angeles. The numbers are down from the border. The numbers of arrests that are being made, apprehensions at the border. It's not going to go away, the pressure at the border for those coming from the Central American countries of Honduras and El Salvador and Guatemala. But it is down, and the pressure is lessening. But, you know, the responsibility of the federal government, once you stop these people, you own them. And we finally are deciding that that's exactly the truth of this whole situation. It may be one thing to go after them. It's another thing to apprehend them. But then it's another thing that you have to take care of them. And in a humane way, acceptable to the American people. And that's what this administration is faced with now. How to do that.
Well, you're right. Except who controls the purse? Congress. Congress has been an unmitigated disaster in this. And you and I have had this conversation before. That's not a Republican or a Democrat problem. It's a Congress problem. And the Democrats didn't take this seriously at first. They belittled Donald Trump for it. I mean, right now the government of Mexico has done more for America's undocumented alien problem than the Democratic Party has. That being said, Congress needs to act on this. And the president needs to do more as well. But boy, I got to tell you, the scenes we're seeing from the border don't look good. But having Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez go down to the border and create havoc over something that probably didn't even happen, but she will tweet about it and her people get all riled up, that's not a good thing either. So, you know, Congress needs to get its act together. And they need to act on this. And unfortunately, right now, both sides think that there's political gain from the status quo.
Matt Klink, let me give you a homework assignment. Our Mexico reporter, Keith Rosenblum, who's covered the border for like three decades and has been a regular on our show for just year after year after endless year, talks about a press conference that the president of Mexico, President Obrador, holds every morning. And he brings all his cabinet members in, and he answers questions for 2 hours, 3 hours, sometimes 4 hours. He says it's the most amazing political show you've ever seen in your life, and it's on every single day. And you can go online and watch it. And he'll answer any question of anybody, and his cabinet members will respond in some compatible way if the question has to do with their particular department. He says you've never seen anything like this. 3 hours every day from the president of Mexico to the people of Mexico. It's unbelievable. You got to watch it. I watched a little bit of it. I couldn't believe it.
Fascinating. I mean, I think that given the grandstanding by the White House reporters who are now more entertainers than hard news folks, I don't know how well that would work in America. And I would hope that the president of the United States doesn't have 3 hours out of every day to answer questions from the news media. I hope he's actually getting stuff done. But, you know, I certainly we need more than we've got now. I'm very disappointed that the White House has gotten away from the daily press briefings. I always found those helpful and interesting. But right now it's such a spectacle that they're really not productive. And also, it would be difficult since Sarah Sanders has left the White House at this point.
Yeah, I'm not suggesting the President of the United States spend 3 hours on that. That would freak me out. I can't even imagine that. But that
TV
is what's happening.
Would eat it up, though.
Well, I guess, yes. But what's happening in Mexico is pretty unusual. Matt Klink, thanks for being with us. I really appreciate you being on the show. Thank you.
My pleasure. I'm going to go Google see if I can catch some of those press conferences. Yeah, it sounds really interesting.
You will not believe it. Thank you so much. All right, appreciate it.
You got it. See you, John. Bye-bye.
Coming up, Paul Cunningham, Ward 2 City Councilman. Apparently a yes. The City Council gives tentative approval for a hotel tax deal that will open a shuttered hotel in the heart of the city. Councilman Paul Cunningham after these messages. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the John C. Scott Political Forum, now in its 31st year of continuous political talk. City Council has given preliminary okays Tuesday to tax incentives to help reopen a downtown hotel and an agreement that could allow a new tribal casino within the city limits of pending federal approval. These are two big damn deal stories. They got a little bit of a headline in the Arizona Daily Star, but it should have been a banner headline across the front page of the Star. I mean, they're finally going to fix the damn hotel that's been shuttered, almost 300 rooms, and just kind of a blight in the heart of the city. And now you're going to maybe have a casino right downtown? Are you kidding? You can walk to it from downtown, take the bus, whatever? This is a big deal. Here's Paul Cunningham, Ward 2 Councilman. Well, Paul, you got this done. Apparently, all these other proposals by Humberto Lopez and HLS Properties on doing something about the shuttered hotel didn't work. Why did this proposal work?
Because the deal that he got is available to any other hotelier in that situation.
So this would have been offered to anybody?
Anybody can get the GPLET has already been used by 16 other people. The incentives, the site-specific sales tax incentive that he's getting, has already been used by a lot of people. There's no goodies and above and beyond. This is a deal which... the GPLET makes the money work for that side. It's exciting that a company like Hyatt Regency, from what I understand, is the company. I'm not sure if it's for sure them, but I think there's a degree of certainty that that's the hotel chain that's coming in. You got to give a hats off to Omar Morales, who's the he's HSL's new director, and he's done a tremendous job in brokering all the details. You know, even in a deal like this that are unique, they're always site-specific depending on valuations and other things, and they made it all work. So, let's see when the work starts, but I'm very optimistic, and I'm really happy to see that happen. I'm also really happy to see, the deal with Pasquiaki is a great deal, but it's pretty early. I think the casino realistically is like 5-6 years away. It'll be a minute. There's still some other discussion. There's a bunch of things that have to happen in between. So if it does happen, great. It's an opportunity because the old Pasquiaki neighborhood's there. It's a good opportunity because it activates a property that has long been forgotten. It's an opportunity because it's an economic driver in what would be an empowered zone. So there's a lot of great things about that deal, but let's not get our eyes too big for our stomach. When we do that, we sometimes fall on our faces.
And well,
so
I think
what
this
really
is
need to do is keep study. And I think both projects will have positive outcomes. And I know it's very boring the way I'm laying it out, but as I've gotten older, sometimes the boring way is the way to get it done, whereas the big sales pitchy schmaltzy way is just a little bit overdone, and it leads to unrealized expectations. So,
well, again,
one time, but I'm really happy about both.
Well, I'm thrilled about them. It just seemed like it was taking forever for Humberto Lopez and his company to come up with a proposal acceptable to the city that would allow the city to work with, obviously, the next hotel management team, as well as Humberto Lopez, to get that hotel back up and running. It's immediately across from the county complex, the city hall. I mean, it's in the heart of the city, almost totally adjacent to the convention center. Good God, and it's been empty. It's been a ghost hotel for how many years? Good Lord. I mean, it's just been a blight in the, on the downtown. And finally, it's about time that it's going to be brought back to life. Congratulations to Mr. Lopez and, of course, to the city council to get this done. And I'll tell you, talk about blight. That whole area where this casino could possibly be built is a blighted area. I mean, there are some really low-income folk over there that are struggling every single day just to make it. But you put a hotel in the middle of that, and you've revitalized that whole corridor that leads from the Grant Road entrance to the rest of the city. That's a big deal. That is a huge deal. Getting a casino within the city limits of Tucson, I mean, we've all come to the conclusion that this casino business is good for all of us, whether you gamble or you don't. It's made everybody money. And so nobody's opposed to it anymore, I don't think, unless it's on some kind of serious religious grounds of some sort. It's money in our pocket, economic development, the idea that we could have the entertainment venue that we have from the casinos that exist today, as well as the money flow. It's been a huge economic boon for Tucson, and so compatible with our resort and vacation lifestyle that we have here for people to come and visit and go back home, that it's just really great news, Paul Cunningham. Really good news.
Well, it helps us out quite a bit. You know, it gives us another edge in some of those tourism dollars that used to flow through Tucson. And speaking of flow, ultimately, both of these properties will be very nearby riverfront, which is also exciting. So I'm pretty happy with the whole triumvirate of things that are happening. I think we're doing amazing things that we've always talked about doing, and now we're actually getting the opportunity to do them. And we'll keep doing them one thing at a time. You know, I've pretty much spent the first 6 years in office just trying to catch our breath and catch up to doing the blocking and tackling, the things that the city should be doing anyway, because it was so neglected. But now that, you know, we have a nice course in road repair and road maintenance, where if we can sustain it, even for the short term, but definitely for the long term, it'll be special. We have a nice backfill of public safety on both sides and a plan moving forward that's funded, and I think we're in a good place there. And finally, we have a good parks plan. And so as those core services take care of themselves, now we have the opportunity to take a look at incentives. We're still a few things away. I'd love to see us get a regional air carrier. We've had some regional air carriers bring flights in the last couple of years. So some of that dream has been revised. But I'd love to say I need one Sky Harbor group to take a chance on Tucson. I need one group at Sky Harbor that's flying 7, 8, 9 destinations in the Sky Harbor to say, hey, we'll just go to Tucson instead. We need one chance like that. I don't know who it's going to be. I don't know if it's going to be a Southwest, an Allegiant, a Delta. It will not be American Airlines. They're pretty much responsible for freezing our airport out of being a destination. So they're kind of the enemy on this. So those are the things that we have going for us. Those are the things that we're proud of. And we're going to keep moving the city forward, whether people like it or not. We're going to keep making Tucson a proud place to be. And that's what I work on every day.
Well, speaking of being a proud place to be, I was at the Benedictine Monastery yesterday for a two-hour broadcast, and Dr. Richard Carmona joined me, the former Surgeon General of the United States, Chuck Huckleberry, the Chief Administrator of Pima County, Steve Kosacek, the Ward 6 council person, the folks from the Catholic Community Services, and the owner of the property, Ross Rolnick. I'm going to tell you something. I'd heard of him, and I've heard what he did and why he was so willing to compromise some of his development plans to enhance not only the viability, but the preservation of a really iconic structure in the heart of Tucson in the purchase of the Benedictine Monastery. I mean, what an amazing person. He sacrificed money. He sacrificed some millions of dollars in order to make this project more compatible and more acceptable to the neighbors and to Tucson, and to make it a better facility, as well as opening the doors over the last few months to these folks who are migrants that are coming through Tucson in search of a better life. This is an amazing story about who we are as Tucsonans, not only from the work that you did and Steve Kosacek did at the council did, but also the 400 volunteers that came together to make this welcome for these literally 12,000 immigrants that have come through here with another destination at the end of the line for them. This is a great story that I'm proud of. I'm really proud to be a Tucsonan because of this. So go ahead.
It's incredible, isn't it?
Yes.
And I kind of want, if you'll indulge me, and I promise there's a point, it'll be a little bit of a ramble here, but I promise there's a point. And it's what makes this story special to me. And so I'm going to tell a story, if that's okay, if you'll indulge me.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
So in 1992, the summer of 1991, I was 17 years old, and the Soviet Union had officially collapsed. And my family that summer, as part of our temple, our church, took a trip to Israel with my mom and my dad and my two sisters. I was the oldest. I was going into my senior year at Rincon High School. And we took our trip to Israel, our pilgrimage, if you will. And we got to Israel, and in the airport set up was people basically living in the airport who had fled Soviet Jews, former Soviet Jews, who had fled the Soviet Union to go live in Israel and find a new life. And there were just bags and satchels stacked all over the airport. And I remember looking at one stack of bags, and my mom pointed them out to me, and she said, "You know, Paul, you're witnessing history here. Imagine right now your mother and your father packing up all your stuff and saying, this is our chance to give a great life to ourselves. This is a chance to give a great life to ourselves." And taking everything you own and going somewhere new and just on faith. Staying at an airport so you can find your life. And so my mom pointed that out to me, and I didn't realize what a big deal it was at the time, but as years went on, it was very special to me. And a few years ago, my sister, she married a physician. He was actually an Army doctor, and he's a great guy. And he went to school in Chicago, public high school, and he graduated. He joined the Army. He put himself through medical school on the GI Bill, and he's been an Army doctor. But something that you don't know about him is that 1992, those bags was his. He was a Russian Jew at the age of about 16 who left the Soviet Union at that time and went to Israel and then ended up in the United States and ended up being a colonel and a doctor in our Army. And when you know those stories and you know those people exist, all you can do is look at the people in the Benedictine monastery and say, "Hey, well, who's that person going to be? And what is this child going to be when they came here with nothing and we gave them hope?" And so that's kind of how I look at this. That's how that's how this is so special to me. It makes me proud to be a Tucsonan, and it's unbelievable what they've done. And again, hats off to Russ Rolney, who I can't tell you what a good guy he's been in this whole scenario. It's jaw dropping and mind boggling how incredible it is, and whenever you're there, just to be a part of something special, and really truly helping people. It's God's work, it's our work, and it's Tucson's work, and it's just something that makes Tucson proud.
Well, Ross Rolney proved that you can have developers with a great name and a great image as neighbors, as friends, as really partners in the future of Tucson. It doesn't always have to be about how much money you make as a developer, but how many friends you made along the way and what kind of development will remain for a great period of time and be an absolutely great part of Tucson. And I think that's what this monastery is going to be forever. I thank to Rolney and of course, Kasachek and others and yourself who have fought to make this a project that we'll all be proud of. It was amazing to watch the eyes of these children yesterday as we toured the facility long before the two-hour broadcast that we were able to put on the air from the Benedictine Monastery, about these children who had walked 1,000 miles across Mexico, 1,000 miles across Mexico to the border, and then put up with what the United States had offered them as obstruction to a better life, and finally got to a point where they came to Tucson, Arizona, and were met by love and friendship and open arms of people who said, how can we help you? I mean, that's what they got when they got here.
And who knows? One of them may someday be one of our Army surgeons.
That's a great story you tell. That's a fabulous story. Paul, thanks for being on the show with us. It's really great to talk with you. I really appreciate your observations, not only on the hotel downtown, but not only what has happened at the Benedictine Monastery, but I think the idea of a casino in the heart of the city, within the boundaries of the city of Tucson, in an area that needs economic development, that could turn the whole portion of downtown into an absolute amazing economic boom for literally hundreds, if not thousands, of people. So we'll watch that unfold as it will. Paul, thanks for being on the air.
John, thanks for having me. You have a great day, sir.
Thank you so much. Paul Cunningham, Ward 2 City Councilman. Coming up next, we'll talk with a lady who's very happy about the new salary schedule at TUSD. TUSD starting teachers with this district, first-year teachers to make $40,000. Margaret Cheney, the president of the Tucson Education Association, the TEA, will be my guest after these messages. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the John C. Scott Political Forum, now in its 31st year of continuous political talk. Well, teachers starting their careers in TUSD are going to make just over $40,000 a year starting the next fiscal year. That's roughly a $1,500 increase compared to last year's base salary. That's because Tucson Unified School District's governing board approved a $552.5 million budget for the upcoming school year. That accounts for nearly $9.6 million in new state funding dedicated to educator raises and capital projects like fixing broken AC systems and repairing aged roofs and all kinds of problems within the district. Margaret Cheney's with us, TEP, a Tucson Education Association TEA president. Margaret, welcome to the show. I'm so glad you could join us. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John. I appreciate it.
All right. You just got off television, right? Channel 9?
Yeah, I did, yes.
I don't want you telling them that it's something you didn't tell us, so what'd you tell them?
Well, they asked, how we felt about the raises, and of course, we feel that it's a great step in the right direction. But the thing that everyone has to remember is that these raises are based on the 2017 level, and that the governor did not give enough money for all of the employees in every district. And so our district is having to spread the wealth, so to speak, amongst our ESPs, because that was our second demand, was a competitive pay for all educational support professionals, and he didn't recognize them.
You know, Margaret, this is a great point, because this isn't the 2020 the governor promised to get 79,000 teachers off his front lawn. This was a promise that he made, but the promise he has not kept. This is not 2020. We're not talking about a 20% raise over 3 years. Where are we? And explain to us why those numbers don't add up.
Well, mostly we are still not at the funding levels we were in 2008. So we're still $1 billion behind. We can continue to give tax breaks to people or to corporations, and our per pupil funding is not near the national average.
So obviously we're going to be playing catch up again. This is the highest starting salary we've seen in TUSD ever, isn't it? I mean, obviously.
True. Absolutely true. So a new teacher gets a good salary when they begin in TUSD. Absolutely.
Is this going to keep some teachers around, do you think, and get some teachers that you wouldn't have? I mean, it's obviously got to be at least a plus when you go out to recruit some good teachers, or those that are going to be good teachers starting out. This is a help, isn't it?
Absolutely. However, I really would like to address retention of teachers as well. And given the funding that our governor is dispersing, it doesn't really allow for us to do that. And I think a really good district has a nice balance between, you know, brand new teachers and seasoned professionals, as we call ourselves.
Well, you're going to have flight from the district again from teachers and really a fairly large number of substitute teachers in those classrooms as you open a new school year, will you not?
I don't believe so. I think that we have hired, that's really a question to ask the district, but I do believe that there have been enough hires. I don't think that they're planning on having the number of substitutes that they had last year. Substitute wages are another issue that needs to be brought to the governor's attention. Because really, without any, you take out any subgroup of educators and really things kind of fall apart at a school. And so it's really all about honoring all of the people in this profession and honoring public education in general, which he just doesn't seem to get.
Let me take you into a subject that I've been involved in with David Safir, who's a former teacher and the editorial and education writer for The Weekly. He and I have been going back and forth about why the district has suffered a flight of students of literally perhaps as many as 1,500 every single year that just don't go back to TUSD. They make other choices. He was saying you take a look at any large urban school district and you're going to see the numbers that have decreased dramatically of those districts that are losing students every single year. In talking with Mark Snegeman and talking with a board member and Lala Counts, a board member, Alita Grijalva, each admitted that there were problems within the district that have to be addressed to stop the flight from the district. And you can't just say, well, it's just one of those market pressures. They've got a lot of more, a lot of charters out there, and they're just going to take X number of students, so we don't have to do anything to be better. But you really do have to do something to be better, don't you? And keep these students.
Absolutely. I think that... Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just saying that David Safir is saying... Well, you can't, I don't think he's saying that all the problems at TUSD are just because of the market forces of a large school district in an urban area losing students to the other choices that parents have. And there's other reasons why people have left TUSD, and those need to be corrected. And that's what I wanted to bring you into the discussion about, of what else the district can do to keep students and keep teachers.
Well, I think our district in particular is kind of under a very interesting scenario in that we have this USP that we also have to follow. And so there are certain guidelines that the special master and the plaintiffs are demanding that kind of put communities and parents kind of scratch their heads at times and think, well, wait a minute. I, for instance, don't want my child to go to a dual language school for whatever reason. But that's my neighborhood school and suddenly that's what it is. And you know, I don't like it, so I'm going to take my kid out and put them someplace else. On the other hand, a dual language school is a great program. And so, you know, I think a lot of some of the factors are just a shift in the mindset and the paradigms of what education is and what public education has to offer. There's also the idea of parents, like myself and as a parent of a TUSD student, the way I received public education and the way my son received public education were very different. The things that were offered, for instance, home economics and driver's ed and, you know, field trips and, you know, you name it. It was there when I was going to school, but it's not there now. And so his response to the classroom has been very different from what mine was. You know, you also have a lot of issues surrounding children with trauma today that I'm not a psychologist, but I'm not going to make a blanket statement. But, you know, we have a lot of students in every district who have gone through much more difficult things than you or I ever went through. We have refugee students. You know, we have homeless students. These are things that we didn't have large numbers of in the past that now we do have. And, you know, every district and every community has to reconcile that and figure out ways to work different populations and changing communities.
You know, part of this money in this new budget goes for capital improvements, air conditioning and really maintenance of these schools, and some of which are very serious when it comes to needed maintenance. So that's a plus, isn't it?
Absolutely. I would hate for another fire panel to go out.
Yeah, looking for a fire.
Right.
You and I joked about that. It's not funny, but the point is that because the alarm system didn't work at one of the major schools, you hired somebody to run around looking for a fire. They didn't find any, but that strikes me as almost bizarre. But
yes.
and funny if it weren't unfunny, which it is. So this particular level of salaries for beginning teachers, will it also extend for more money for those who are senior teachers that you want to keep because they're just really good at what they do and they've been there for a while?
Well, everyone's going to get the same amount. So if you've been here for 20 years, you'll get $1,500. If this is your first year, you get $1,500. So, you know, for first-year teachers, that's a nice chunk. For someone who's been here 20, they might be thinking, you know, I could do better. And so, you know, that is the difficulty. In that, you know, on the one hand, you want to bring in more teachers, but on the other hand, you still have to compensate, as I said, your senior teachers, and so in order to keep them. And so what do? You only have so much funding from the state. And either, you know, you could take all of your money and spend it on salaries, which, you know, yay. But on the other hand, well, wait a minute, we still got missing ceiling tiles and, you know, carpeting that needs replacing and books that need replacing. And, you know, you name it, it needs updating. And so how do you balance that? And I would really, if it were solely up to me, I would really like to address that next year. But I don't know what the governor has in mind. There was quite the fight with the budget this past spring. You know, there was some question as to whether or not they would even give us the 5% as promised. So, you know, I'm ready to continue to write and fight for Red for Ed.
I'm curious now that these numbers are in. We really don't know what the attrition rate is. Do we have enrollment figures for this coming school year, or it's too early for that, right?
I don't have any enrollment figures, but I did hear during the budget talk that we had lost, I believe, up to 1,200 kids.
Which is pretty much what it's been happening over the last few years, right? Between 1,000 and 1,500.
Yeah.
How about teachers? Mm-hmm. Have you stopped the bleeding from the teachers that are leaving TUSD? Do you have a number?
I don't have a number for that. I would say that we definitely don't have as many senior teachers. That's for sure. We've had a lot of people retire, a lot of people move out of state. But as far as what the ratios are, the actual numbers, I'm sorry, I don't have a figure for that.
You know, I think the great hope for this district is to stop this bleeding and stop the attrition rate. If you can cut that back and stabilize the enrollment figures at TUSD, and also increase the number of teachers who are well-paid, and we're not talking about just paid, but well-paid, I think you can stabilize TUSD basically where it is, because I don't think you can continue to see this these numbers that are diminishing the enrollment of TUSD continue forever. I mean, they take the money with them when they go. And that's a negative, obviously. That has to be brought into control. I don't know how close you are to being able to do that. Do you know?
I'm going to say it's going to take a little while. It might even take a change in our legislature for teachers to say, and parents to say, okay, now we can look at something consistent. Our kids need consistency in the classroom. We need consistent pay. We need consistent work conditions. We need ed support professionals who feel valued and feel that they can, you know, make a living doing what they do. With all of those things in place, I think we will stabilize. But I don't see that happening in the next couple of years. I think it's going to take a real shift politically, to be honest with you, of either Republicans who really, really support public education and or Democrats who really, really support public education as well. There can't be a negative on that one.
You know, in our conversations between you and me, you didn't get in this profession just to make money. If you did, you made a mistake along the way.
Yeah.
There's a satisfaction. I've told this story I don't know how many times. My mother was a sixth grade teacher at Independence, Kansas, a little town about 12,000 in southeast Kansas, for 30 some years. That's a long time to be a sixth grade teacher. And she wasn't in it for the money. Her retirement was hardly anything. The salary was negligible almost. But people coming to her door thanking her for the education they received and the attention that she paid to them was a tremendous rewarding part of what she had chosen to do. Now, obviously, it was a salary, it wasn't a lot. And, of course, it helped us along the way to make it on a little five-acre farm. But the truth of the matter is, you don't get into this business for the money. And there's a reward. Talk about that reward just for a moment. For those that might be considering this, going, well, $40,000 is not much. When it gets to $80,000, call me, you know.
Right. Well, I mean, you're not dealing with a product. Children are not products. They're people. They're little people. And you know, it's wonderful to see the reaction on their faces when something clicks, and then years later when they call or they write or they, you know, stop by and they remind you of who they were and where they sat. And, you know, you've had hundreds of students since then. And so some of them you recognize and some of them you don't. And some of them you wonder about the rest of your life. I've had friends who worked for this district for over 40 years because they absolutely love what they're doing. And I always say, you know, if you go into this thinking, oh, I'm just here to make the money, you don't get it. You should go into business. You should go into, you know, retail or I don't know, whatever other things make money. That doesn't mean though that you shouldn't make a living wage, and it doesn't mean that you shouldn't gradually become a more stable middle class as we used to be. You know, we teachers used to be part of the middle class, and it just boggles my mind that we aren't anymore. But like you said, it's really a lot of it has to do with that, those little people in our classrooms and the effect that we have on them, the relationships that are built, and then, you know, what becomes of them as they get older. And it's just, it truly is amazing. I in my current position, I don't get to actually be in the classroom, and I do miss it at times. And you know, there are other times and I think, oh, I'm so glad I don't have all those papers to grade. But for the most part, that those interactions with those individuals, it was just phenomenal.
Yeah, you go to a elementary schools. I've done with all three of my children in TUSD, and you see the hugs that teachers give these young children, whether they're fifth grade, sixth grade, or one first grade, whatever. And there's a real relationship of affection, love, commitment, and hope for these kids that I don't think is found in any other relationship outside of the home other than in that classroom. And that
exactly.
is something that we have to keep in mind as we thank the people like yourself and others for giving our next generation an opportunity to be successful. Thanks very much, Margaret, for being on our show. I appreciate you commenting on the salary increases for the starting teachers as well as the starting salaries for others. We'll talk again soon. Thanks for being with us. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
You bet. Margaret Cheney, TEA, Tucson Education Association President. Coming up next after the news at the top of the hour, Jeff Rogers, former chair of the Democratic Party, one of the best defense lawyers in all of America. We'll talk about Donald Trump backing the besieged Secretary of Labor as an official is under scrutiny in Florida for that sex trafficking case and may have been protected by, well, the Secretary of Labor. Jeff Rogers next.